It is Saturday, May 5th, 2007, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, our Week in Geek news segment, genetically engineered crops, and in the second half, your questions and comments of technology. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, we have Michelle Marvet, an expert on risk assessment for genetically engineered crops. During the second half of the show, I'll welcome you to join our conversation. You can ask us anything you'd like. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can contact us right now. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about half an hour. GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Miles Elam, Slacker Geek and student. Welcome, Miles.
Good morning.
Sean Cleveland, Technical Marketing Manager at NVIDIA. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Drew Meyer, Product Manager at Network Appliance.
Good morning, Lyle.
We're going to start our news out today before we get into genetically engineered crops and the risk assessment of them. We're going to start out our news with you, Mr. Sean Cleveland.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I would like to wish everybody a happy Cinco de Mayo.
That's quite right.
Cinco de Mayo.
You guys partying tonight?
Si, senor.
All right, good.
Party every night.
Yeah. Miles, you are a party.
That's his real title. Slacker Geek is his pseudo title.
That's what goes along with Slacker, isn't it? You're always partying.
It's a job responsibility.
Right. So I also want to remind people that today is Free Comic Book Day.
What?
Yes.
I mean, I can go to any comic book store and take a comic?
Pretty much. Well, the comics that they offer you.
You have anyone take any comics?
So on the first Saturday in May of every year, a few thousand comic stores across the world give away a few million comic books for free. Yes, comic books for both young and mature are being given away. They're free. If you're listening in Santa Cruz, there are three different stores in town that you can go to: Atlantis Fantasy World on Cedar Street, Clubhouse Comics on Soquel Avenue, and Comicopolis on Water Street. I called all three of them yesterday, and they're all giving away comics today for Free Comic Book Day.
Do I now know your route today? Is that what you're going to do? You're going to hit all three of them?
Yeah, right after the show, I'm going to. You've
probably already been there this morning.
No, I haven't. They're probably not even open yet. Well, they're opening now. So a bunch of comics, kids' comics, Archie, Mickey Mouse, Peanuts, Simpsons, Transformers, Gumby, superhero comics like Iron Man, Incredible Hulk, Spider-Man, Justice League. Go get them. They're free.
Well, Sean, when I was a kid, I read comic books, was really into them, and then I put them down for years. And then I ran into you, and you took me up to Berkeley to a really great comic store.
Yeah, Comic Relief.
Comic Relief. And
the
owner.
My favorite store.
And I go, you know, I don't really read comics. And the owner hands me this great book called Understanding Comics by Scott McCloud. And read that book and totally reinvigorated my interest in comics.
Yeah.
It is such a wonderful art form.
Yeah.
Wonderful way of communication. And it's ancient. So I highly recommend first Scott McCloud's book, Understanding Comics, if you don't read comics. And get it today while you go get free comics, because you'll appreciate them. I think anybody would appreciate them.
It's amazing where that's gotten to now.
Well, I was going to ask you for a different news story, but that was great. So now let's go on to Mr. Miles. What's up with Dig? What is Dig.com?
Dig.com is a social networking site that's based upon the principle of democratic news gathering. In other words, the people who are reading the site are also the ones who are submitting the stories. And then they each will vote or choose to dig up or dig down a particular story. So as the story gets more popular, it goes closer and closer to the front page.
And any of the users are able to post a story?
Yes.
Yeah, this is Dig spelled with two Gs, D-I-G-G. Right.
Where the problem came about was with the high-definition DVD or HD-DVD consortium, a key was released that would allow decryption of HD-DVD content. This was huge.
That's actually a big news story in and of itself.
In and of itself. And that key is normally shown as several pairs of hexadecimal numbers.
It's just a large number. Okay.
Yeah, it's a large number. What the HD-DVD consortium had said is that that number is their property, is copywritten. And people are going, whoa, wait a second. It's a number. How do you copyright a number? That's like copywriting, you know, a word.
I want one. Anybody right, zero, exactly. Anybody?
And Dig was saying, no, according to the law, this is what they have. We don't want to get in trouble. So they started to take the stories off and to
Well, the people who administer the site.
Right, the people who administer the site were removing content.
In a non-democratic way, then. In a
right,
kind of,
and suspending users' accounts.
Okay, wait a second. Just one back up one thing. Was there risk for Dig in publishing this number? Is there
quite probably
some, okay
in our current environment? Yes,
because the Digital Millennium Act, it's illegal to break any kind of encryption. This potentially is a key. Therefore, it is
right.
To
they're
some
treating it. They were also looking at it as a circumvention mechanism. Yeah.
Right. The other thing, I mean, like if I took the key to your house, got a copy of it somehow, scanned it, and put it up online, I'm actually giving people access to your house. So to some degree, that would be, and that's. I mean, you could represent that as a number. It's all it is, you know, millimeters of depth in your key. So is it equivalent to that? I mean, we call it a key. Is it like that?
Yeah, it is fairly similar to that, okay. Yeah. Although the key in and of itself is not a decryption mechanism. It is just the seed for their pseudo-random value for the encryption on the disks. Mm-hmm. But yes, a lot of the criticism that comes in is that with HD-DVD and DVD before it, that unless you had a player that went along with it, either they came with Mac or came with Windows,
right.
Linux users were definitely subject to this. Couldn't play the movies that they paid for,
right?
Because it didn't exist for their operating system.
You have to have
system,
software that passes
legally.
This key to the hardware to be able to play the thing, and that's how
right.
it works.
And right. as Alex actually points out online here, it's a crime to break into someone's house, but that's a different thing than getting a copy of the key and posting.
And that's a good
that.
Point. And then, of course, this all gets confusing because I can buy a DVD, but personally shouldn't be able to know this key, even though I own the content that's encrypted with it.
Right.
So it's a pretty complicated
right.
situation.
But this isn't really the story.
Okay, get into the Dig thing. So Dig decides kind of the controllers of this democratic environment decide to take things down and kind of punish the people that post this information.
Right.
Was there a revolt?
There was, in fact, a revolt. What happened was, over a very short period of time, I actually happen to be a reader of Dig, avid reader, and love seeing the stories that are on there. The entire front page was overrun with this HEDVD decryption key.
So thousands, perhaps millions of people were voting on as many stories as they could.
Right.
To make sure that those came to the top of the dig.com
front
page. The
entire site was covered with this right. thing that they were trying to get rid of.
What's the benefit in having your story at the top? Why, is this just an ego trip?
No. It's mostly an ego trip. It's getting that message out. There have been a lot of political messages coming out, like about Ron Paul and
it's
other
a great way to deal,
like
deal with news because it's not it's the most recent stories and with some kind of algorithm to determine the most well-read and well-liked story. So it's kind of a collective way of making things popular.
Right.
And
instead
it's still
of like
run
the O.J. Simpson thing coming up all over and over again, it becomes very much a, I don't want to hear about O.J. Simpson again, and you start digging it down. And
so the democratic nature is what's attractive to you, but this behavior is taking that apart.
Well, that's because it was it was a breaking of the system.
Right.
They had broken it, so then the
well,
users decided
to... Well, it wasn't really broken, though. What many people, including what surprised me, Forbes online was saying, was it was the equivalent of a digital Boston Tea Party.
Right. Yeah.
You're doing something that is completely unacceptable to us, and the power behind Dig is the users.
Right.
Without all the users, Dig is a pointless site. And so if you're doing something contrary to the user's wishes, then suddenly it's going to be a problem. And I don't think that this is going to be something that the general public is going to remember, that they're
right.
going to care
okay.
about. But I do think it's going to be something that the content providers who do
what's,
social networking sites are going to be watching out for.
I agree. So what's the conclusion of this situation? Are all the Dig users upset, or did Dig change their perspective?
So after the site became – bear in mind, this is a site that when they link to other sites, they usually bring them down because
right.
there's so much traffic, coming to them. Dig was getting slow. And at one point in the evening, a couple of nights ago, the site just went offline and had a warning message saying, we're working on stuff that'll come back up in a little bit. It had been overloaded, basically. They basically said uncle.
Right.
The people who administer Dig basically said, all right, we were trying to do it to avoid litigation, but
right. Kevin Rose, actually one of the starters of Dig,
right.
his response in a post, which the title of the post is that number, which is the key. But now, after seeing hundreds of stories and reading thousands of comments, you've made it clear you'd rather see Dig go down fighting then bow down to bigger company. We hear you, and effectively immediately we won't delete stories and comments containing the code, and we'll deal with whatever consequences might apply. So they're basically saying, okay, the users want this, and he's okay with risking his company with a lawsuit from the company, the owners of the key. So it's pretty, it's a very interesting way of
responding. And there are two quick things I do want to mention that add to the story, which is, one, no other social site did the same thing. No other site, such as Slashdot or Reddit, took down the equivalent post, did the same type of action. In fact, have done quite the opposite in the past. And also, Dig.com and their show Dig Nation that goes along with it is heavily funded by the HDDVD consortium. They have a partnership. And so there was a people were seeing an interest there. That
Okay, I want to go on with other stories. Thank you so much. I want to get a couple more stories in. Drew.
So along with this Freedom of the Press story, that's fascinating, Miles. Just this week, the editor-in-chief Harry McCracken of PC World magazine, he's an award-winning editor. He's been there for 12 years. He resigned under some controversy, not on his part, but that his new manager, Colin Crawford, the senior vice president of online at IDG, which is the publisher, asked him not to publish a story that was critical about Apple because Apple is one of the heavy advertisers in PC World. Now, if you haven't heard of PC World, I have an uncited source here, but the Wikipedia mentions that it's the largest circulation computing magazine in the world, 850,000 audited rate customers
as of 2006.
That's it?
This is not...
God, what's happened to
print media, remember, is shrinking dramatically. But still, this is a significant player in the world of print media for high tech. So Harry's left after 12 years over, again, this conflict.
And did they do that technically? I mean, did they restrict their editorial judgments?
The editor, Harry, was restricted from running this story. It was going to be called 10 Things We Hate About Apple.
And they decided not to run it. Even though it was
in addition to this, apparently the head of PC World was a former CEO of Macworld.
He's newly appointed as this head of PC World, so his history is a little bit awkward here. And I think that
are any of us being paid not to say something bad about a company?
No, absolutely.
I'm not getting paid for it.
Luckily, this is public radio. We don't have underwriting.
We don't make any money at all.
Oh yeah,
we don't
have.
It's an interesting comment on the challenge that media faces between who pays for the space for them to talk about things.
We're going to have one more story because I really want to get to our guest, Michelle, who's waiting for us. So one more thing. What's up with Netgear? What did they do recently?
Oh, I thought you were going to ask about Microsoft buying Yahoo.
No.
Oh, that hasn't happened yet.
Is that going to happen?
Or Dell shipping Linux.
There is talk that yes, they might do that. But in the meantime, let's talk about something that really did happen. Yes, Netgear was purchased by...
No. Netgear purchased.
Netgear purchased Infrant. Now, we've had Infrant on the show, I think, a couple times. They make a network-attached storage device, a box that holds anywhere from 1 to 4 hard drives that sits on a network, gigabit if you're lucky, and allows you to back up and store data in a redundant way, so that if one drive fails,
this is a consumer level, small business device. Sub $2,500 roughly.
So these guys are chip makers, right? And they even have a patent pending RAID technology that allows RAID to expand as you add hard drives. Getting that alone is difficult because a lot of people have this sort of thing.
Yeah.
But it is kind of neat that they took. Nobody would buy their chip, and a lot of networking RAID companies, they have this problem. They make this cool, they design this chip, they go to sell it, right? And they said, if no one's going to buy our chip, let's just make our own box.
And they made a really good box.
And they made a really good box. It was a really difficult thing to do. And I've kind of been talking to the director of marketing there for the past couple
of
years. He's a good friend of mine. And boy, he's had quite a challenge. In fact, he tried to get me on board at one time to help out with marketing and then
I got
PR.
One of these.
And now they got bought for... I think they have 23 employees, and they were bought for $60 million.
Wow.
And they have an install base of around 20,000
units. How close
is
this friend of yours?
Unfortunately, they were privately held.
It's impressive. Sam Feng, who's the director there, he's been on GeekSpeak a couple times. He's a good guy, and they've gone with a guerrilla marketing strategy that's created a fanatically loyal user base. In fact, there's a very active wiki for their product, so people who are interested in using it can go and read about it and learn what other people have done and constantly expand its capabilities.
I wasn't even aware of the wiki or that environment. The only thing I knew is that when Sam came in, he gave me a unit to try out, and I loved it, and I bought one for work because it was such an easy out of the box. But in buying it about a year ago, it was difficult to find. I couldn't find it through a lot of the vendors of user UCSC. Now it's everywhere. So it's really been successful in this product. And it's a relatively inexpensive product for what it does.
I've never heard of one failing.
No.
Mine just runs.
It's a great unit.
You've hit a point there, Lyle. The challenge for Infrant was was distribution. It takes a lot of money to build a channel. How do you get your product out to market? And as we all know, Netgear is very well ensconced in the most of the computing channel today.
And so that's what's exciting about this, is that if you know, Netgear is there to move this product, we're going to see a lot more home storage solutions that have redundancy. Yeah, yeah.
We should hope so. Now, Netgear's tried this a couple of times in the past. In fact, some of the places I've worked, people have gone on to Netgear to try to start a storage division. And it's just not, hasn't been the right time. But remember, Cisco bought Linksys 2 years ago now. And that's been a great channel for Linksys to get new storage products into smaller businesses. So Netgear's kind of going the other way, and I think they'll see some market share.
And Netgear, of course, has a huge consumer-level brand. I mean, there are a lot of
our
routers.
Oh, yeah, number two after Linksys, It's a great position for
all right, friend. Wonderful. Michelle Marvais is an associate professor and executive director of environmental studies at Santa Clara University College of Arts and Sciences. We welcome her now on to GeekSpeak. Michelle, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you for being so patient with us. So I've been reading your article. Actually, Drew set this up because it's such a great topic, genetically engineered crops. Now, you have an article that I've been reading about pharmaceutical crops. And, of course, your real foci is about risk assessment with genetically engineered crops. So let's talk a little bit about...
Actually, it's genetically modified organisms, right, Michelle? GMO? Is that the terminology you guys use?
They're called genetically modified organisms, genetically engineered organisms, transgenic organisms. So there's a lot of different terms that are thrown around that really mean pretty much the same thing, that scientists have either synthesized genes or they've taken genes out of one species and inserted them into the DNA of a different species.
And what do you do, and how do you... What do you do with, I mean, why are you talking about these kinds of things in these scientific journals?
Well, my work is actually not making these types of organisms, but rather I've been looking at how the risk assessment is done. What exactly is the government requiring the companies, they're mostly done by companies, although there's some universities involved, what is the government requiring that those companies do before they say, okay, this is safe, we can go ahead and do this, either just really everywhere, deregulate it completely and let everybody grow it, or for things that are like pharmaceutical crops, they're never going to deregulate it, but they may say, you know, it's okay, we can grow a few hundred acres of this somewhere.
This stuff all sounds kind of science fiction to me, modifying genes and making mutations, and it sounds kind of, there's a lot of, you know, fiction around this stuff. So let's get a little clear about what we're really talking about here. When you say you take a gene out of one organism and put it in another organism, what is that gene? What's the goal of moving that gene around? What does that gene do for the new organism you're creating?
Well, you can really. You're right saying it's like science fiction. I mean, I don't think anybody ever wrote science fiction that you know, imagined that we could have cornfields producing insulin. But the goal could be anything. For example, they've taken green fluorescent protein genes out of corals and sea anemones and put them into fish. And you can buy these fish. They will glow and they fluoresce. And so the goal can be something kind of silly like that, to make a fish glow, or it could be to, you know, make a crop plant produce a new drug. So it's kind of unlimited.
We covered that fish story.
We also configured a goat story making spider silk.
Yeah, spider silk in the goat milk. So what's so harmful about this? Who cares if the fish glows? I mean, it's not natural.
I would assume that fish getting out in the water wouldn't do so hot because everything would see it.
Well, it's more
it,
for
right?
fish bowls.
For fish tanks, right?
Fish tanks.
Our own. Okay, so...
I like the idea. I'd buy one.
Would you?
If it's cheap.
We actually can over the internet.
What's so bad about that, Michelle? Why is there a risk management element here?
What is the risk?
Well, I don't think there's much of a risk with the glowing fish, frankly, but... Some of the things that are being done, like putting a gene that produces a drug into a food plant, well, those are supposed to be grown under highly contained circumstances. And the goal is to grow the drug and then purify the drug and sell it as a pill or a shot, just like any other drug, without letting it get out into the food system. And I think that's where the real risk comes in, is when something like that gets out into corn that's going to be turned into cornflakes or into rice that's going to be made into Rice Krispies. That's
okay.
When we start getting the risks.
Let's talk about something. First off, what that glowing stuff or the insulin, these are just proteins. These are just parts of is that the right term for them?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
So the genes are going to be coding for proteins, and the proteins could be proteins that cause the fish to fluoresce, or they could be insulin, which is a protein.
Could Dow Chemicals do this process inside one of its chemical sites, you know, make these proteins in mass with chemistry?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, actually, the way a lot of these drugs are currently being produced is in large vats using genetically engineered bacteria. Oh. So there's already genetic engineering happening to produce drugs of different types, but it's being done indoors in highly contained facilities where presumably the risks are minimal that there's going to be any sort of escape into the wild.
You take like a yeast kind of thing and you modify it to make these proteins and you build it in these giant vats.
Right.
So what is the what's the purpose of moving from this vat type of genetically engineered stuff into kind of a into our air process? Because I mean, maize or corn is it pollinates through the air, right? I mean,
right. It's wind pollinated and produces lots and lots of pollen that moves on the wind. The main advantage of moving into something like corn is that corn kernels are filled with protein, and so you can get a lot of production in of a drug, and it would be stored in the corn kernels. And then, if you dry corn kernels down, the proteins remain really stable for a very long time. So you could store it for a long time. You could ship it other places and so forth before you extract the protein to make the drug.
So it's more efficient than doing it in a lab.
Exactly.
And
of course, in the lab, too, you have to have all all the power has to be from electricity that goes in the lab to make the vats warm and to do all that. And, of course, if you're out in the field, you get to use sunlight.
That's true, although there's a lot of other energy inputs that go into growing
now,
corn.
I do have a question here, because a lot of this has that ick feeling. This sounds really weird. I mean, this is something true in a lot of sciences, that you have this ick feeling.
Right.
My scientific term for it, yeah.
Thank you.
So, at the same time, we have genetically modified food crops for centuries, for millennia. Lyle, it reminded me when he mentioned maize, because while maize is still used, our corn is not naturally produced.
The EU's been fighting it.
The corn that naturally arose.
We've been modifying crops since we put the first plow into the earth.
Right.
That's
so
the general
so
concept.
Where's the difference there, or what's the concern?
Right. Well, the difference is that, you know, the way we've genetically engineered or genetically modified crops in the past is just through artificial selection, by taking the plants that have the right traits and then using those to produce the seed for the next year. And so it's fundamentally different from what we're doing now, which is taking a gene from, for example, a human and putting it into a corn plant so that the corn plant will produce a human protein that we then want to, concentrate up and re-deliver to people as a drug. So the types of traits that you can get a corn plant to do now, I mean, it's way beyond what a corn plant would ever naturally do. You can take gene from any organism, bacteria.
So you're saying kind of that even though we've been modifying by selection, by the kind of the normal natural process, it's a very slow process, and now we're able to do things that have never happened, like putting insulin in corn. Is that a true case? Are we able to do that?
Well, antithrombin has been put into
so
rice,
yeah,
for example.
Things that
lactoferrin.
Are genetic. It wouldn't be this something is, that we would be producing the next 10,000 years if we did it in a more traditional way.
No. Mm-hmm. I don't think corn would ever... I don't think there's any way that you could ever get corn to produce antithrombin, for example, or lactoferrin or lysozyme. This is something where you're really mixing and matching genes across kingdoms in this case, right? We're going from humans into corn. That's something that wouldn't occur in nature.
Right. We are speaking with Associate Professor Michelle Marvais about genetically engineered crops. GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447.
KOSP co-sponsors the 10th Annual Queer Youth Leadership Awards, presented in part by the Diversity Center in Santa Cruz. The celebration takes place on Saturday, May 19th at 6 p.m. in Harbor High School in Santa Cruz, and includes a dinner, variety show, award ceremony, and a community dance. For more information, please call 427-4004 or go online to qyla2007.org.
This is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. That was Drew Meyer. We also have Sean Cleveland and Miles Elam. We're all speaking with Michelle Marvais, an associate professor of biology and... Oh, I can't recall. But Michelle's joining us. We're talking about genetically engineered crops, genetically engineering organisms. And we'd welcome you to join our conversation, ask questions and comments on topic. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, 476-2800 or 1-800-655-5877. You can ask us questions through the internet if you'd like. Just go to geekspeak.org. Michelle is an associate professor and executive director of environmental studies at Santa Clarita University College of Arts and Sciences. She is an expert on risk assessment in genetically engineered crops, and we really welcome you to join the conversation asking questions about that. Stay tuned with GeekSpeak. Stay tuned with KUSP for Castle Cottage this morning at 11 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. The phone numbers to join our conversation right now are 476-2800. Again, 476-2800. Or toll-free anywhere in California, 1-800-655-5877. Again, 1-800-655-KUSP.
So, Michelle, I'm still not quite clear on the risk factor. We know that it's not likely that corn will ever produce some of these things that we're asking it to produce. But what's so bad about the pollen drifting between fields, other than the unknown factor, right?
Well, for some of the drugs that are going to be produced in corn, these are things that we know we don't want children, for example, healthy children who aren't lacking these proteins, to be consuming them. So there's a real risk of contamination of the food supply. It would probably be at very low levels, but even at low levels, I don't think we want people who don't need drugs to be consuming them.
So
that
makes
sense.
This little item that's been modified into a crop to make a new drug, to make this new protein, this crop now has the potential to reproduce and to create that?
On its own?
Yeah. I mean, the plant is basically turned into a little factory where it's going to be synthesizing the drug, and then the drug gets stored in the
kernel.
Grain, basically, if it's a rice grain or in the corn kernel. So the plant's going to be doing that, and they usually use things like detasseling for corn to...
What's that?
You know how the top of the corn plant has this big tassel that produces all the pollen?
Right.
They would come through the fields and cut off those tassels so that the pollen wouldn't be just roaming around freely.
Why don't we sterilize the corn plant?
Actually,
that's a good idea.
Yeah. There's a movement to require that we do have the technology to make male sterile plants or to prevent there from being pollen produced, but it's not required right now by the USDA.
So the potential, though, would be a field of stuff that makes a thing that you don't want in the food supply, and then that plant actually reproduces somewhere else, and now all of a sudden just normal corn that's growing, now some percentage of it has these drug-enabling proteins in it. So now you're going to potentially be eating cornflakes and this protein's in it, and you don't want people to have that protein. Is that the risk that we're talking about?
Yeah, that's the risk we're talking about. And I mean, the USDA has a lot of rules in place to prevent this kind of thing from happening. It's not like this is just happening on any farm anywhere. These field sites where pharmaceutical corn or pharmaceutical rice would be grown, they have to be isolated from other fields by some minimum distance. For corn, it's 1 mile. There has to be no other corn around for a mile. They have to grow the corn at a different time, you know, like shift it by about a month away from when other corn in the area would be planted. So they are trying to create, you know, strict rules where these types of contamination events wouldn't occur. The problem is that people are involved. And I've said this in a lot of my writings, that whenever people are involved, you're going to have human error. And what we've seen, if you look at the history of genetically modified crops, is just one misstep after another. One example of people just not following the rules precisely, or somebody mixing up labels and shipping the wrong thing somewhere.
Yeah,
and
I have a question actually a little bit on different lines, which is with regard to when you're talking about corn or some similar plant producing insulin, there are... some folks who have insulin through animal products right now, and there's a big movement against having animal products for these medicines or animal testing. Have you had any response from folks that when you're trying to move to a plant-based, is that part of any risk assessments or any type of content you've ever received?
Absolutely. It's one of the big benefits that's expected from using plants rather than animals to produce these drugs is that if you're using animals to produce them, then there's certain viruses that the animals have that could infect people.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you use plants instead to produce the drugs, there's actually less risk of disease for people. It also should be cheaper.
And it's more humane to some degree if people are concerned about animals being raised for that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's another concern is, you know, the animal rights issues involved with using.
Okay, so you have a history of studying the risk assessment of genetically engineered organisms in general. Corn has been modified quite a bit to produce the corn that we use right now, not necessarily for the food, but for like not for pharmaceuticals. Can you tell me about how well we've been doing? You've said that we've been doing genetically engineered and we've been having case studies and it's been kind of bad. Can you tell us a little bit of what kind of cases have happened? How good are we at controlling these plants?
Well, I mean, there's been a number of cases in the news where major corporations have accidentally released genetically modified corn or rice before it had been approved release.
Okay, so these aren't pharmaceuticals. What is the genetic modification to these things that were then released?
There's one example of a herbicide-tolerant canola that is called GT200, produced by Monsanto. And it was found in a lot of Canadian canola is used to, it's the plant you grow to make canola oil. And it was, this GT200 was found sort of at low levels throughout Canadian canola. And
so what you're saying is they took the plant and some scientists went, well, how can we make this plant more tolerant to pesticides so we can spray the fields and kill off weeds and not kill our crop?
Exactly.
So they modify the plant, adding this ability to be more resistant to pesticides. They release it into a small test environment where one company decides to do this. They, of course, do a whole bunch of patents on it. So they're going to make canola oil cheaper because they can spray the fields and not get as much junk in there and put a lot of chemicals on the plants. So then they do this, and then a few years later, all of a sudden, almost all canola plants in Canada have this trait.
Not all, but it's present at really low levels. So it's not like when contamination events occur, it's not like all the canola has changed over to this new type, but rather it's just present at low levels. But it wasn't supposed to be there.
Mm. So the risk factor that you're talking about and analyzing is, what do we do when this happens and how should we prevent it? And you're making recommendations to governments?
I've been focusing a lot on the testing that happens before things are approved for widespread use.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, is that it seems to me that if I'm going to modify a plant, I'm going to have to go through some kind of regulatory body that says it's okay for you to start planting this stuff.
Absolutely. In fact, there's going to be several regulatory bodies involved in most cases. Certainly the USDA will be involved, and the Environmental Protection Agency is also involved if the plant that you're talking about has pesticidal properties or will affect pesticide use.
This would strike me as a pretty major international trade discussion as well.
It absolutely is, and in fact, a recent contamination of our long-grained rice in the southeastern United States caused rice farmers in that area to lose a lot of money because Europe decided it wouldn't import our long-grain rice.
Any of the long-grain rice, or just the genetically engineered stuff?
Well,
how do you know?
What happened was the Liberty, it was another type of herbicide-resistant rice. It contaminated all of the rice at very low levels again, but Europe decided it wasn't interested in importing any of our rice because of that. And there was about $150 million of loss for our rice industry.
Wow. Now, the other thing that's kind of interesting, of course, is that this contamination did not yield all this rice as didn't have this trait that was really required. It just is contaminated, if you will, but doesn't actually have the ability to resist. Is that right?
Well, yeah, just a few of the plants in a whole field of rice would have that trait, but that's enough that the European Union, because it hadn't been tested to see if it was safe, the European Union wasn't interested in importing any of our rice that had potentially been contaminated.
What is their fear about this stuff? Is it the idea that, well, what if some protein in this that now makes it immune to pesticides can also make people blind? Is that the fear?
Well, probably something more subtle than that. But, I mean, if you think about allergens, most allergens are proteins. And so it's possible by introducing a new protein into a crop plant, you're also introducing a new allergen.
So do they test for that stuff, that type of stuff?
Well,
maybe they don't have the resources to test for that kind of stuff.
How do you protect yourself against that? You're going to test everything that comes into your country for every possible genetic modification?
Or you just don't let it in.
Yeah, it's easier to say no.
Okay, but we're letting it in. I mean, it's growing here. It's in our rice.
Well, we're Americans.
Let's start taking some questions for some Americans.
Hey, I've got one more question before we take it. And this is kind of the flip side, Michelle. Clearly there are benefits to this. I mean, there are markets that are asking for it. And some of the articles that you've written talk about, you know, heartwarming examples of delivering vaccines to third world children through bananas. That makes a lot of sense. And there's clearly some benefit, right?
Yeah, I think there definitely is the opportunity to have this stuff be very beneficial. Those vaccines are not yet being delivered, but that's one of the things people are working on. FDA, obviously, the Food and Drug Administration, obviously also gets involved when we're talking about drugs or vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
So there's still a lot of things in the testing phase. None of these drugs that are produced in genetically modified plants are yet on the market. You cannot buy them yet, but they're in the testing phase.
Let's go ahead and take a call from Santa Cruz. Steve, welcome to GeekSpeak. Steve, what's your question today?
Yeah, well, I have a couple of comments and a question. One comment is there's a locally produced video that's available in Spanish, English, and Chinese on genetically modified trees, and it's narrated by Dr. David Suzuki, and it's available through customflix.com on the web.
Okay, what's your question?
And my question is there any place locally where we know that some of these crops are being grown or tested?
Oh, that's a good question. Let's see. There's not a lot of genetically modified crops currently being grown in the state of California. Most of the corn that's grown throughout the United States is at this point genetically modified to be resistant to insects. But there's not a lot of that going on in California. There's discussion of genetically modified grapes for vineyards. And there was, of course, the very notorious case of Ventria, a company up in, Ventria was growing pharmaceutical rice in Sacramento, just a few hundred acres of it, but they have been asked to leave, basically, so they're in, I think they're in Missouri at this point. They tried to go to North Carolina, so there has been some genetically modified pharmaceutical crops grown in the state of California. There's definitely been some field trials that have been approved for the state of California.
When we're talking about these genetically modified crops for the purpose of pharmaceuticals, aren't we normally talking about taking these crops and then we process them a lot and get the chemical out and use it, or get the protein out and use it? Why would you use something that we could eat? Why not use a plant like your article mentions tobacco, but I know poison oak grows really well and has seeds. I mean, why not use something that we don't want to eat, and then there's not a fear of us eating it?
That's a great point. And a number of experts have said that, you know, this should be done in something that's not a food crop. If we're gonna produce drugs in plants, we should be doing it in, you know, something that's inedible to people. And that makes a lot of sense, I think. The main reason or the main rationale for continuing to do it in a food crop is just that they have such large seeds. These grains are so large and they store so much protein that it makes it very efficient, and therefore hopefully drug prices would be less expensive.
Basically what you're saying is since we've been spending since we put the plow in the earth, we've been making these crops really good at making proteins because
right.
That's what we want
and
for food.
Them up in big, giant
so we have
grains.
this great corn crop, which is this modification of maize, which is just really good, dense way of making protein, so of course use that. That's the idea?
Pretty much, yeah.
Right,
and it's the most efficient way to produce the drugs. If
Steve,
you're using tobacco...
Can I make another
yes,
comment?
Yes, Steve, please make one more comment, yes.
Yeah, I think we're also missing that something eats everything. So just saying, well, let's trade off human health against animal health or insect health doesn't necessarily mean that we end up with a better situation.
Ecosystem, yeah.
And the other thing is to remember that, you know, we're around because we've managed through natural selection to survive for millions of years as an organism, but so have those plants. And so once those plants have these genes, to think that somehow they won't be around for millions of years and that these new genes might not have some, you know, really horrible effect over time is to let something out of the bag that is, you know, really
impossible
completely
to put
unnatural
back. Yeah.
And has really nothing to do with the kind of plant breeding and
thank
that
you.
Has been going on throughout
thank you, Steve.
Our history.
Yeah, thank you,
thanks.
Steve, for your comments and questions.
Those are two excellent points. I mean, there really isn't much done in the regulatory system to protect wildlife. The regulations are all meant to protect people from these proteins, and you know, there's no netting required over the top of these pharmaceutical fields to prevent birds from coming in, and other wildlife is just going to be moving in and out of the field.
Wow.
Also, Steve's second point about how this is potentially irreversible, I think, is hugely important. This is very different from most other technologies, even chemicals. As bad as a pesticide or an herbicide may be, it will eventually break down in the environment. And when you're talking about genes, you're talking about, you know, changing living organisms that are reproducing, evolving, moving to new locations, and, you know, it potentially is letting the genie out of the bottle. And really, we have no way of knowing if we could ever stops or recall a transgene once it's out.
You are listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell, in the air with Drew Meyer, Sean Cleveland, Miles Elam. We're talking to Michelle Marvay about genetically engineered crops. You are actually listening to Geek Speak, though it's not exactly what we normally do. It's very geeky. And Michelle, I wanted to thank you so much for being here to talk about genetically engineered crops. It's nice to hear that there's a lot of risk, because I, as a geek, I really embrace technology in a lot of ways, and when I hear people complaining about certain things, I'm like, you know, relax a little bit. It's, people are smart. We're going to figure it out. I have this kind of, this general
this
feeling.
Faith.
Things are okay. I have faith in humanity and with technology. It doesn't scare me as much. But what you're saying about genetic engineering, I really hear I really hear why people are scared of it. It does seem a little scary to me.
Well, the reason Michelle writes these articles is to talk about this risk and to raise it, because I don't really think that I trust Monsanto to watch out for my interests versus a new economic interest for them. Is that about fair, Michelle? Is that what you're about here?
Well, I think there is also a lot of potential benefit here. I don't want to just make it sound like this is really scary. I think things could be done. Certain traits could be put into plants and into animals that would be very, very beneficial for many people. But I do think we need to move a little slow on this front, because it is potentially permanent changes we're talking about.
Yeah, let's take another call from Watsonville. Judith, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, yeah, thanks for this show. It's very interesting. I have concern about potential undesirable ill effects of the changes to the like food crops, I think, more than the pharmaceutical crops, perhaps even. But it seems like there are things like they put in some terminator genes in some crops, and they put in, they design them so that they have like more pest resistance, so that it's like they have like pesticide right in the crops itself. Is that accurate?
That's
and
right.
I'm just wondering, you know, like the Terminator thing, I don't know whether that could cause a problem, you know, in terms of seed reproduction. But the other, I'm concerned, how much are they doing testing of the effects of these foods on people before they release them?
Judith, thank you for the question.
Yeah, those are good. Those are good points. You're right about there being pesticidal properties in some of the plants now, and mostly what they're doing is taking genes from a bacterium called Bacillus thuringiensis, or BT for short, and they take these BT genes and put them into corn or rice or whatever, so that the plant produces an insecticide. The good thing about this is that these are insecticides that are very, very specific to particular groups of insects, and as far as we know, are not harmful to people.
And they're contained in the plant, so it's not like the field's being sprayed and they're not being washed away. They're actually inside the plant.
Right, and so they're being produced by the plant all the time. On the other hand, that's sort of the flip side of it. They don't, they're not just sprayed temporarily and then they go away, but they're being produced by the plant throughout the entire growing season. Generally, because BT is something that occurs naturally in the environment, it's something actually organic farmers have been using as a spray of bacteria for a long time. There's not a lot of concern about BT for human health. It seems to be pretty safe. But what I am concerned about is that the studies that are done to look at, you know, what are the effects on ladybugs and honeybees and earthworms and so forth, those studies tend to be really poorly done. And that's one of my major research areas.
What do you mean poorly done?
Well, they'll have just a few insects in each treatment. You know, so maybe they'll have six ladybugs exposed to the BT and six that aren't, or six groups of 10, maybe. But that's really low replication. When you compare it to something like a human drug trial, where there'll be thousands of people in each treatment to see, you know, if there's side effects of a drug. So they're basically doing pretty weak studies, short-term studies, that don't really give you a lot of confidence that there's not side effects.
Who's doing the studies?
The industry that makes the genetically modified crops and makes the profits does the safety testing.
Yeah. That doesn't sound right. I mean, it sounds like that's not a... I mean, who's looking at the reports, then, of its safety?
Well, those reports are then submitted to the Environmental Protection Agency and the USDA.
Well, why aren't they saying, hey, your sample size is too small?
Well, you know, they actually set the minimum sample sizes pretty low for these studies. So the companies are doing what is required. They're doing the bare minimum of what's required
We need a regulatory body that's more separated from the industry, it sounds
like. Judith also mentioned a terminator gene. What's that?
The terminator genes are genes that prevent the plants from reproducing. And actually, you could see why there would be a lot of benefit for that, especially with pharmaceutical crops where you don't want them reproducing on their own. You want to have it be very controlled. We grow them only when we grow them, and they don't reproduce beyond that. But the main reason why companies have been interested in terminator genes is so that they can control their patents. And so farmers can't save seed from one season to the next. They have to go back to the company and purchase the seed every year.
Let's go ahead and take a call from Big Sur. Jim, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
Good morning. What's your question today, Jim?
Question is this. In terms of disease agents that attack plants, for instance, sudden oak death, is it feasible to capture those spores or whatever those microorganisms are that float in on the fog, modify them so that they need whatever they need to survive, we don't have around here, you know.
To kill them off, you mean?
Put them off their oak food.
That's an interesting idea. It'd probably be easier to try and genetically engineer the oaks to be resistant to the pathogen. But then you're...
Because what's happening, of course, is this: the sudden oak disease that grows, if you captured some and modified it not to grow well on oaks, then that part of it, then you released it, it wouldn't grow well on oaks. But the stuff you didn't capture would still do really well.
That's right.
Yeah,
so,
but doesn't that... There's a way to also make a modification that stuff breeds or works with other stuff and modifies the other stuff too?
Yeah, what you're talking about sounds a lot like what they're trying to do with mosquitoes to prevent malaria.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's it. That's where I heard something like that.
Yeah, they're trying to create mosquitoes that don't get infected by Plasmodium, which is the cause of malaria, and also make these same mosquitoes better at reproducing and surviving.
That's
so
the trick.
They'll outcompete the other mosquitoes.
Right.
That
and that's the trick with it, is you have to make sure that the organism is better at than the original. And that kind of scares me, the idea of making better mosquitoes. Why would we want to do that? But it's to get rid of malaria seems like a pretty good trade-off.
I disagree. Isn't one change, whether it's good or bad, that's a purely a judgment decision we make today. If we start monkeying with anything, it's just... Whether it's good or bad, it doesn't matter. We've made a change.
Yeah, maybe this organism that attacks oaks doesn't just attack oaks anymore.
Attacks pines?
I don't know. Maybe was that comment, though? That's easy for us to say in a country that malaria isn't a big deal.
Yeah. Right.
That's right.
Thank you, Jim, for the call.
Thanks a lot.
This is tricky stuff, Michelle. Can you sleep okay every night?
Yeah, I manage to. But, I think that one of the points that came up there was that, anytime we make a change, we're changing things. And that's true with everything we do. And everything we do has risks. And so, really, we just need to try and balance the benefits and the risks and make sure that those are spread fairly among different people as
let's
well.
Let's say you get to rewrite the rules about governance of this stuff. What kind of things would you want to put in place so that we could keep on doing this genetic modification but be a lot safer?
And along with that, what would your recommendations be for our listeners, for us who are buying products?
Okay. If I could write the rules to regulate these things, I would certainly require larger sample sizes and larger scale studies for longer durations to look for the side effects on the environment. And I'd also require that those studies be accessible to the public, that they're easily sort of compiled into a single database where people could look up what's going on, how much has this been tested, and they could be reassured if, in fact, everything looks safe and the studies are well done, they could be reassured by looking at these data.
And what's against that idea of doing that? Why isn't that in place then, if those are good ideas?
Well, I think one thing that slowed that down is this idea of confidential business information, that many companies don't want their competitors to know exactly what they're up to. And so
nobody does.
Yeah, exactly. And if you look at some of the databases that are available at the USDA website, many of the things that are being worked on, it just says CBI, confidential business information. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of, it's not very reassuring to the public, I think. And so there's a big trade-off for these companies. They want to stay competitive, but they also want the public to be supportive.
So short from moving to England, where they don't allow almost any genetically engineered crops, what can we do in the United States to be better consumers of produce and crops and pharmaceuticals to some degree soon?
Well, if you're interested in avoiding genetically modified crops, the only way you can really do that right now in the United States is to buy organic, because one of the regulations in the organic standards is that there should be no genetically modified content. Even there could be pretty low levels of contamination, but
Right. The
farmers are at least not intentionally growing these things.
But still, isn't that somewhat disingenuous? Like I said, the fact that all of our crops have been genetically modified for thousands of years just through selective breeding. It's a much slower process, but it's still genetic modification nonetheless.
That's true. I mean, we're not hunter-gatherers just getting berries off of plants at this point, but genetic modification is pretty different in the fact that they're taking either synthetic genes or genes from other species that wouldn't normally be in your corn or your rice and moving them in there. So you're getting the production of really novel proteins. And because they're not labeled here in the United States, I don't think we really know for sure that there isn't some, you know, long-term health effects. I'm not saying there are. They may very well be perfectly safe, but because consumers don't have an easy choice, things aren't labeled, it's not easy to avoid them, you don't really have groups of people who are eating them and groups of people who aren't eating them that you can compare over the long term.
You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. We're talking to Michelle Marvais, Associate Professor and Executive Director, Environmental Studies at College of Arts and Sciences, University of Silicon Valley.
Santa Clara,
excuse me.
Which is in the Silicon Valley.
And she recently released this article in California Agriculture called Pharmaceutical Crops Have a Mixed Outlook in California, which piqued our interest on Geek Speak. And her focus is on risk assessment for plants. And Michelle, I wanted to thank you for being with us today on Geek Speak. I really appreciate it.
Michelle, is there a place where folks can go to read more about this that you would recommend?
Let's see. I would recommend Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, and it touches a little bit on some of the genetically modified issues. It's a great book. I don't know. There's lots of good stuff out there on this. Nothing else.
You're not much of a self-promoter. That's great.
You can also go to geekspeak.org, of course, and link over to Michelle's work. A lot of her papers are online. And, of course, you can pick up the most recent copy of California Agriculture. Agriculture, thanks.
Agricultura.
Thank you so much, and thank you for being on Geekspeak. If there's one thing what do you do, just out of curiosity, what do you do to protect yourself, if you will? Do you eat only organics?
No, I don't. I do prefer organic, but actually for different reasons. but no, I don't, like I said, I do sleep fine at night. I'm not paranoid about this stuff. I just wish that we would have stricter testing of safety up front.
Great. Michelle Marvais, thank you so much for being on Geek Speak today.
Thank you.
The geeks this morning were Drew Meyer, Sean Cleveland, and Miles Elam. Thank you for participating in Geek Speak, geeks.
Our pleasure.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you, Lyle.
And thank you for listening to Geek Speak. To those that called in, thanks for making Geek Speak what it is. Without you, it would just be us geeking out, and who wants to listen to that? Our guest today was Michelle Marvais. You can find more information by going to geekspeak.org. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. Coming up next is Castle Cottage, so stay tuned for that. Geek Speak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH Santa Ana, on the web at kusp.org. For KUSP and Geek Speak, I'm Lyle Troxell.